waking up to it and wanting to talk about it as well. So thank you so much for coming on KABU today.
As you know, I'm always happy to talk to you.
All right. And thank you, audience, for listening and tuning in. Please tune in next week to Positively Revolting. I'll have you a guest and a great conversation. Last British man in Guantanamo. Stuck in a cell alone, though the U.S. says it wants to let him go.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop, Saturday, October 28th at the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland. The Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop welcomes all to attend this free, life-changing training, which incorporates traditional Native American teachings through stories, exercises, and discussions that are even more relevant and needed today. These workshops are conducted in a respectful way that is both healing and empowering. Again, that is Decolonizing Our Activism Workshop on Saturday, October 28th, 10 a.m. to 5:30 p.m. at the Native American Youth and Family Center, 5135 Northeast Columbia Boulevard, Portland, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KABU Community Radio is proud to present David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Journalist, author, and activist David Barsamian will be speaking about the broad coalition in opposition to the Trump administration, which includes activists from a range of causes, progressive Democrats, and concerned Republicans. He'll be reflecting on the core issues at stake today and why so many people from such a range of identities and perspectives are challenging the administration. Again, that's KABU Presents David Barsamian, Resistance in the Age of Trump, on Sunday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland.
And as promised, well, it's 9 a.m. on KBOO Portland. As promised, this is One Land, Many Voices.
صباح الخير يا ولاد عمومنا تفضلوا شرفونا شو بتحب مضيفكم دم عربي ولا دموع من عيوننا بعتقد هيك تأملوا نستقبل من هيك تعقدوا لما تدركموا على غلطة من هيك لبسنا الكوفي البيضة والسودة صاروا كلاب الزمان يلبسوها كمودة مهما تفننوا فيها مهما غيروا بلونة كوفية عربية بتضل عربية حطتنا بدنا إياه ثقافتنا بدنا إياه كرامتنا بدنا إياه كل شي إلنا بدنا إياه ما رح نسكت لن نسمح لن ليك ليك لا بقلن يسرقوا شغلة مش إلهن ما خصن فيه قلدونا بلبس لبس هالأرض بكفيهنش طمعانين عالقدس قدس اعرفوا كيف تكونوا بشر قلبي بتلبسوا كوفية جينا نذكرن مين إحنا وغصب عن أبوهم هي حطتنا من هيك لبسنا الكوفية لأننا وطنية الكوفية كوفية عربية من هيك لبسنا الكوفية هويتنا الأساسية الكوفية كوفية عربية يلا علي الكوفية علولي هالكوفية
Hi everybody, here we are watching a movie called The Radius of Resistance here in Portland, Oregon. And we are really lucky to have with us here the movie director, Jesse Roberts. Welcome, Jesse. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thanks.
Thanks for allowing us to interview you at this short notice. We really appreciate it. Tell us a little bit about you. Tell the audience in Portland, Oregon about you.
Yeah, my name is Jesse Roberts, and I'm from Bend, Oregon. And I started an organization called Rise Up International, and sort of our core belief is using the arts to build bridges between culture, whether it be film, whether it be music, and art in general. We believe that arts is a universal sort of avenue, that connect people around the world. So myself personally, I've been an artist, and you know, I first went to Palestine about 5 years ago. Initially, actually got some funding to do some art programs in Jordan with Palestinian refugees, and then eventually came, you know, to started working in the West Bank. I started working in throughout the Arab Spring doing some journalism. I worked on a film called Push Tunisia at the end of the revolution in Tunisia, and an opportunity came through that film to start, you know, to go to Jordan. And, you know, for me, coming, you know, growing up in the West, I've always had sort of the Israeli perspective. You know, I grew up kind of in a Christian Zionist home. And so, you know, for me, working with Palestinian refugees in Oregon, I mean, in, you know, coming from Oregon, going to Jordan, started just hearing another side of the story. And I met people who literally, you know, still had the titles to their houses, who, you know, were ordered, you know, at gunpoint to leave. You know, I met people who literally, like, walked. There's a family that I'm still friends with who, you know, they walked on foot from Palestine to Iraq. And, you know, I've become friends with their children. And so, you know, just being there, hearing people's stories, it kind of really opened my eyes about the situation.
Of course. And so the movie Radius of Resistance, like, would you please tell us a little bit about the movie and how did it came together?
Yeah, I mean, the issue with Israel-Palestine is it's huge, you know, and I spent, you know, a few years going in and out, doing some journalism, trying to understand the situation, and trying to wrap my mind, you know, on how we could tell a story. And for me, you know, I heard about these two young girls from this village in Nabi Saleh, and, you know, Nabi Saleh, it's really different than a lot of villages in Palestine, where it's, you know, a lot of the demonstrations, the community groups are women-led, and these girls were just really, really powerful. And for me, you know, I realized that, you know, it would take, you know, several movies to try to describe the whole situation, but we wanted to tell the story of really one family, one village, as kind of a microcosm of Israel-Palestine and the occupation of the West Bank.
Exactly. And talking about Palestine, you know, like, there is all of this wild spectrum of, like, events and different situations. Like, for example, you have, like, the siege in Gaza, you have, like, the checkpoints, you have, like, the city of Hebron specific situation that have, like, the settlement in the middle, and you have the annexation wall and all of these situations. And also, like, we are not forgetting Bal'in and, like, all the clashes that's happening in every demonstration every week. And I remember watching the movie when we were talking about a weekly demonstration happening in Nabi Saleh. So tell us more about this weekly demonstration and what's the role of, like, Jana Jihad and Ahed Tamimi. Like, how did, what's their role in stuff like this? And why did you choose Nabi Saleh in particular?
Yeah, so in every village in Palestine, there's different reasons that people demonstrate. In specifically in Nabi Saleh, the Israeli settlement, illegal settlement, took their spring. And so symbolically, they marched towards the spring every Friday. In different villages, different reasons. Some of the villages, you know, maybe the settlement took the road. In this particular one, I was really drawn because, again, you know, women were really part of the leadership. And specifically, you know, there was this girl, Jana. When I first met her, she was 7 years old. And she was documenting when I first met her with her cell phone. She was in, and I think for me, you know, I did a training years ago just trying to understand the idea of solidarity and the role of journalists. And I think there's part of The idea is like that's a protection in a sense to Palestinians, you know, especially if there's local journalists like Jana, her uncle, that are showing some of the abuses that happen. If there's foreigners that come, you know, it helps shed a light on the situation. And like Israel really doesn't like, they don't like that. You know, I lived with two Italian journalists who were both shot. I was with them two separate times. One was shot by a sniper, almost died. He was shot, you know, in the chest. It almost hit his heart. He was in critical condition. I was with another journalist, an Italian lady, who got hit in the face with a rubber bullet. Even filming this documentary, you know, we were shot at with live bullets. You know, I've had Palestinian kids in front of me that have been shot. So, you know, I've seen firsthand that, like, Israel, there's not violence that goes on in these demonstrations. You know, these largely, there's even Israelis who come and support, you know, the documentation. But, you know, the way that the soldiers react is really disproportionate to what's happening.
Yeah, speaking of like documenting and like you and you found Jana Jihad, and probably she's like the youngest journalist in Palestine right now. You know, like how scary is the photo, the video, is to the state of Israel in terms of like trying to expose what's on the ground? You know, like Israel always come and tell us here in the first world that we are the only democracy in the Middle East. Like how, like a kid with a smartphone, as you said, like impact the hegemony of the state of Israel on the facts on the ground.
Right. Well, you know, again, you know, I've seen Israel really come against journalism. You know, a lot of friends that I've had, and even myself, it's becoming more and more difficult for me to get through the borders. Typically, I'll get questioned and pulled aside for hours. A lot of my friends that I've worked with that are journalists have been banned by Israel. They give people like a 10-year ban if they consider them sort of like an enemy of the state. And you know, again, if you speak in universities in the U.S. or the Western world, kind of against their policies, then they consider you an enemy. And again, I'm not talking about violent people. I'm talking about people who are just going over with a camera, people that are doing reports. You know, really, it's kind of like this form of nationalism, you know, where they don't want kind of opposing voices.
With like all what's going on with your journey filming this movie, you know, like what's the most touching moment, you know, like that all the time, you know, like brings you back to your time back in Palestine doing and filming this movie?
You know, for us, we literally, you know, had no money. We went just because we were passionate about this project, and the village really opened their heart to us. You know, we literally, by the end of the film, we were like living with the family and staying with them and eating with them. And, you know, we saw that there's this picture that the West paints that the Palestinians are terrorists or they're violent, but they were so hospitable. And you know, that's the thing that really sticks with me is, you know, I feel like we have sort of a Palestinian family that is like family to me. And now when I go back, it's like seeing, you know, my family, and there's so much love that they have towards us, which is, it's pretty amazing.
There's a footage of Ahed Tamimi and Jana Jihad in the movie from 2012. You know, like, have you got a chance to talk to them, like, recently, 2017? And like, what was their reactions during a time like, for example, the war in Gaza?
Yeah, I mean, we've continued our relationship. I've been back. We got some funding to be able to show it in Palestine. The premiere that we did was in Palestine. We did several cities, and you know, they continue to be active. You know, they're still, you know, active doing the demonstrations. The last time I was there, I actually filmed out with a drone at one of the demonstrations, and there was like 5 kids that were shot. The film just finished, so we're going to do a Q&A on the stage.
We're going to end this interview. Hopefully, we can see you again and again, and we are really thankful for all of your efforts. Is there any final words you want to say in 1 second or two?
Yeah, no, I appreciate the interview. And again, our organization is called Rise Up International, so you can check us out online. And, you know, we're supported by a lot of different people. So thanks for interviewing us.
My name is Jenna. I live in Palestine, in Minnesota. Like most children around the world, I wake up in the morning and I put on my shoes, brush my teeth, brush my hair, and go to school.
There really is life before you meet Jenna and then life after you meet Jenna.
She really changed my life. You know, she had this presence and this power that was really mind-blowing.
And she, a very special surprise tonight, she has something to say to you guys.
Hello, for the people in Portland, thank you for watching our documentary, Radiance of Resistance. I wish that you enjoyed it and our message just came in your heart. I wish that you can send our message to your friends and your friends could send it to their friends. Like that, our message could go to the whole community and you can be the voice of the Palestinian children who suffer. I wish that you can relay that we are the next generation that can make a difference in this world. So just let's look hand to hand to make this world a world of peace, love, and equality. Let's liberate Palestine and liberate this world. Thank you very much.
I'll start with Peter. You want to introduce yourself? And
hi, I'm Peter Miller. I'm with Americans United for Palestinian Human Rights here in Portland. We've been... my group has been working on this issue for about 17 years in Portland. And we have a sign-up sheet in the back if you want to sign up for alerts about Palestine-related events. We also have these map cards that talk about the disappearing Palestine. I think it was shown in the movie. And you can have your own personal copy of what's going on right here. Here at the bottom is a link to our website that talks a little bit more about what's happening in terms of the disappearing Palestine. And indeed, the Israeli government right now is aggressively reducing the territory of the Palestinians and demolishing homes and doing everything that you saw in that movie. And this is one example. A Portland photographer took a picture of these young women, Bedouins, but they aren't they're Israeli citizens, curiously enough. They aren't in the West Bank. And their village has been demolished by Israel more than 60 times because they want them to be expelled from where they're living. So this is going across in Israel, in the West Bank, and the siege of Gaza is just having terrible consequences. And Americans are responsible because of our support and funding. So we encourage you to, as Americans, let's take some responsibility for helping these people.
Yes. Hi, my name is Asma Taha, and I volunteer for Palestinian Children Relief Fund, which is a non-religious and non-political organization. And basically, we provide medical aid to children in the West Bank and Gaza. I just want to say a few things about things that you touched on in the movie or the film. Unfortunately, the Israelis under the understanding that Palestinian people don't like their kids. They don't love their kids. The people who are old enough maybe remember one of the prime minister in Israel in 1969, Golda Meir. She basically once said that we will have peace when Palestinian loves their children. And that's absolutely not true. We do love our children. But when you have nothing left, your house at, in danger of being lost, your kids have no safe environment to grow up in, Your kids have no access to health care or proper education. You know, what else can you do but resist? So they touch on this message a couple of times, and I do volunteer in the West Bank and Gaza often. And I interact with the Israelis as well, and I hear that from them. And I try to explain that we do love our kids. It's very hard for a mother and for a father that basically they try to get help for their own children who are sick, who need help, and they cannot get it. So what would you do? I would resist. So thank you again for bringing the voice of those Palestinian children, and I think you guys did a great job. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a tough thing. I mean, there's so many emotions coming back from Palestine to America and seeing like all of us kind of just walking around kind of blind to what's going on. So it's a start. We just have to start the conversation, start talking about Palestine more, and start actually researching what's going on over there. And then from that, and hopefully this film will help educate some people, then we can start to maybe change some of the politics and change some of the idealistic wild stuff going on in Israel and in the West Bank. One more thing I would like to say, Kevin Prather, KP, can you stand real quick? This guy right here, give a round of applause for him. He did all the animation in the film. He's an amazing artist here in Portland. So thanks a lot, KP. All right.
For me personally, you know, growing up in the States, kind of having this narrative that was shaped, you know, just growing up in this culture, you know, going to Palestine over the course of 5 years, you know, I came across Jana and Ahed, and it was just really special to have, you know, to find this village that was, again, woman-led movement. You know, Jesse and I, you know, since making this film, we've been able to go back. You know, we've been able to establish relationships with the village. You know, by the end of the film, you know, we were staying in their house. They've been so hospitable to us. You know, and now we've been able to go back, and we feel like we're part of their family. It's really neat. It's a really special relationship. And, you know, especially, you know, as in the world in general, you know, nationalism is growing. The last time that I was there, I was filming a demonstration with a drone, and there was 5 kids that were shot with live, you know, ammo. You know, Joshua was with me during that time. And, you know, for us, you know, we see this, and, you know, we did this 3 years ago, and, you know, we really did this with no budget. There were some, you know, people that supported us. But we want to continue to get better as far as our storytelling. You know, it helps us to have your feedback, you know, your questions. I got connected through a Palestinian friend to the village in Nami Saleh. I saw some videos that she had taken. She was filming with her phone, some soldiers, and I was just really drawn to her. She seemed like this really, you know, she seemed, you know, beyond her age, really. Like her, and I heard her talk first on some videos, and then when we met her, it was really powerful.
This is happening right now in our lifetime. So to me, that kind of like, if you sit with that idea for a second, you actually can make a change in your life. This humongous oppression is happening right now in the world. So it's time to start. What now? Yes, it's time to start now. Researching, figuring out for yourself. I got lucky enough to go there and see with my own eyes and see what the heck was going on. And once that happens, obviously it's a game changer and like it changed my entire life. So, but figure it out. It's happening right now. This isn't in the history books. So it's a crazy thing. And to touch on the soundtrack, that was a guy from, I'm from Bend, Oregon. And that was a local guy in Bend. And the editing, I tried to make it similar to what I felt when I was there. It was very schizophrenic. You wouldn't know. There's so much psychological warfare going on as well. They would shut a road off. The next day, it's open. 2 hours later, there's armed guards searching, strip searching people. You never knew. You were never comfortable. And I kind of wanted to have that feel throughout the film, too. I would like kind of lull you into a situation and then go, bam, there's a soldier. Because that's how I felt when I was there.
I mean, and that's the thing. This is just one village. And in doing this story, you know, in my mind, it's like, how do we tell the whole story of Israel-Palestine? It's so huge. And for us, we wanted to focus on one village, one family, a few girls. because the trauma that happens is countrywide. You know, it's that's just one layer of the occupation.
I could say that Israel has a systematic policy of arresting children in the dead of night and taking them into prison. In fact, there's campaigns fighting this process in the United States. No Child Left Behind, I believe, is the campaign that the children are arrested out of. No Way to Treat a Child. Sorry, No Way to Treat a Child, which is No Way to Treat a Child, and it happens systematically in the West Bank. And in Gaza, you know, you've heard of post-traumatic stress syndrome. In Gaza, they can call it continuous traumatic stress syndrome because the stress has never been relieved of the people. So you can imagine the effect of children on continuous stress like that.
And another tactic of theirs is to disable youth, especially young boys from like age 14 to 18. They like to shoot them in the knees. And so that's a part of not just physical, but also psychological warfare against the children living there.
Yeah, I mean, Israel locks up more children than any other country in the whole world. And because it's under the occupation, you know, the prison systems aren't governed. You know, they have sort of just free reign to do whatever they want. And so that there is a systematic trauma that happens because they're coming in. And again, when they come in, we were just there recently, and it happened while we were there. I mean, they come 1 in the morning, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning. You saw it in the film, you know, come breaking through the doors, pounding on the doors, pulling the kids out of bed. I mean, kids as young as 7, 8 years old, you know, it is psychological warfare. So there's been legislation that's been proposed to outlaw. I mean, the thing is, going a little bit further back, you know, how did the apartheid stop in South Africa? You know, it happened through boycott, divestment. So it's been a strategy of activists. Again, you know, these are nonviolent strategies. That's the whole, everything that we're trying to do is nonviolent. And even that is not allowed. You know, we see even in our own country, can you be an NFL player and protest in a way without having criticism? I mean, it's even much more.
There's a Senate bill right now, Senate Bill S-720, that will criminalize a company, but we also believe it includes individuals, for abiding by any kind of boycott information they receive from, for instance, the United Nations, which is starting to list companies that are complicit with Israel's occupation. And you can be subject up to 20 years in prison and $1 million fine for doing any boycott activity under this bill. And Senator Wyden of Oregon supports this bill. So that's one example of our complicity. And our governor, Kate Brown, with all the other 50 governors, so she's not unusual in this, support anti-BDS statement that is against us trying to do any action to stop what's going on. And so we are so complicit, the average American really doesn't realize the depth to which our government, our senators, our congressmen, our governors are making us complicit. And it's really time for people to kind of wake up about that.
Yeah, and the Israeli Knesset has already, you know, passed a law where if you've, you know, been a part of the BDS movement anyway, then you're banned. I mean, you can show up as a U.S. citizen, you know, if they think, I mean, even for us as filmmakers doing this film, they can deny us, you know, entry. I mean, that's very, very common.
Right. I think so. If you guys want to research this online, I think it's bdsmovement.net. Is that correct? bdsmovement.net.
تراثنا الشاهد على وجودنا من هيك لبست الثوب الفلسطيني من حفا جنين جبل النار الى رام الله خليني اشوف الكوفيه البيضه والحمره خلينا نعليها لفوق بالسما انا هجاه ديت العرب الثاني بخص غزه الثاني بهز هزكلي ماتي حرب سجل انا شاد يا منصور والحطه هويتي من يوم ما خلقت سيدي والشعب مسؤوليتي لك انا تربيت بين الغرب وبين الشرق.
You're listening to an interview with the acclaimed political. Oh! That was KBOO's own Mohammed Nabil speaking with filmmakers from Bend, Oregon. The new film, Radiance of Resistance, told through the eyes of two young Palestinian journalists. Coming up in part two of the program, we'll hear an interview with political cartoonist Khalil Bendib, and he'll have two events in Portland this weekend to promote his new book about Edward Snowden and whistleblowing. Both events will be held at the First Congregational Church in downtown Portland at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. Saturday at 7 p.m. will be a reception and meet and greet with the artist, and at 3 p.m. Sunday, he will give a lecture called The Pen is Mightier Than the Sword. In just a moment, we will hear part two of today's program, interview with political cartoonist Khalil Bendib, who has two events coming right here in town. We'll repeat that information at the end of the program, so stay tuned.
Hi, Portland. Good morning. This is Mohammed Nabil, and I am your host for One Land, Many Voices. Today, I have with me a great Arab-American artist, Khalil Bendib. He's an Algerian-American who was born in Paris. Hi, Portland. Good morning. This is the Battle of Algiers, and he's now like based in Berkeley, California, and pursuing his art journey through political cartoon and sculpturing. So, welcome, Khalil. How are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you, Mohammed. It's great to be with you.
I understand that you do political cartoon. Like, if you can tell us a little bit, you know, like, how did you start and how, like, why satire through political cartoon was, like, your medium?
It's a great question. I always tell the media that I started when I was about probably 2.5 years old, not knowing what I was doing. The first drawings I ever remembered making were of an Algerian soldier saluting the Algerian flag, the banned Algerian flag, because this was before independence.
Mm-hmm.
And I was now in Rabat. We had escaped from Algeria via Paris, because we were under death threat. We were going to be wiped out. So I remember making my first drawings, and already they were political. I didn't know they were political cartoons, but I was so obsessed with the war in Algeria because my parents, that's all they could talk about. There was no TV back then, but they were listening to the big radio they had there in front of them every day, wondering what would happen the next day, when would Algeria become free and all that. So I had the politics in my blood, so to speak, and I guess the drawing and the political were always linked in some fashion in my consciousness. I really started doing cartoons that were published when I was 15 years old in Algeria. And right there, I encountered some political censorship because we had a so-called socialist government under Houari Boumediene, who, you know, was not really very democratic. And I had some problems with it. Even as a kid, I was very politicized. And I did the cartoon. I did the six small strips. And again, they were political. I guess I couldn't help myself. One of them was mildly critical of the government, making fun, poking gentle fun, and the editor's reaction was very edifying for me to see him blanch and say, "You wanted me to get shot? Are you crazy? Are you out of your mind? I'm never going to publish this one." So that told me there was a problem in terms of freedom of speech in my own country. And the next time that I published, 6 years later, or so, I was here in this country as a student. I was at USC in Los Angeles. And there as well, I encountered some form of censorship. Not too bad, because it was a student newspaper. But I would get a lot of reactions, and especially from either Israelis or Zionists, mostly Zionists, people who just couldn't stand somebody who would say certain things about Palestine that were not said in the mainstream media. So very early on, I came up against the juggernaut of political groupthink, you know, that was really reflecting the brainwashing that our mainstream media constantly do, especially when it comes to a question like Palestine. So I still managed to have a career in spite of that, because I didn't do just cartoons about Palestine, and people really reacted very well to the cartoons in general. When it came to Palestine, it was also a little bit of a problem, especially after I became a political, professional political cartoonist with the Gannett chain of newspapers at the San Bernardino Sun. And I can tell you more if you want to know about the censorship there, but it's been a long litany of coming up against this wall of you can't say certain things about Israel, you can't say certain things about Palestine. And I still managed to do it, regardless of the censorship, regardless of pressures.
What was the context of the the cartoons that was about Palestine that received these blowbacks from the Israelis and the Zionists?
There are a lot of them. I can give you one example that stays with me, obviously, in 1985, when the Achille Lauro, I don't know if you remember, maybe you're too young to remember that. This was more than 30 years ago. I was at USC. This handicapped Jewish American man had been thrown overboard from a ship off of the Egyptian shore. And back then, this was not the PLO. It was an extremist group by the name of Abu Nidal. I don't know if you remember.
I remember.
And that was not a very good thing, obviously, and people here, even pro-Palestinians like Alex Arde, who was a leader in the Palestinian-American and Arab-American community, came up on the media defending the PLO, saying, well, it wasn't the PLO. The PLO actually denounced this terrible thing that happened. It's not representing Palestinians. Unfortunately, the next day, he was blown up in his office. They put a bomb in his office, and that was the JDL, Jewish Defense League, so-called Jewish Defense League in this country. And when that happened to Alex, I coincidentally had, and I knew Alex very well, mm-hmm. So it was a big shock to me. He was a very peaceful man, a poet, a teacher. I ended up doing a big bronze sculpture to commemorate him in Santa Ana. But when that happened, I happened to have the same day a cartoon against Israel, because Israel had bombed Tunis, the headquarters of the PLO in Tunis. Back then, the PLO had been expelled entirely from the Middle East, from Lebanon, and they were in Tunisia. And when that happened, I thought, well, what's next? Next thing I know, they'll be bombing Algiers. These guys have no limits. They just go, not only destroy Palestine, destroy the Middle East, now they're coming to my home. So I did a really scathing cartoon of an Israeli boot crushing innocent people. And I got some death threats from the newspaper, the student newspaper. Three times somebody called and said they would take care of me, they will take care of me. Didn't take it seriously until I heard what happened to Alex. Then I started taking it very seriously, and I would double-check the under the hood of my car, thinking maybe they're coming after me next. You know, they just killed somebody I knew right here in Southern California. So that cartoon in particular I will always remember, but I've done dozens, maybe hundreds of them, defending the Palestinian and, I mean, the fair point of view from my perspective, the underdog.
Yeah, every time I talk about like cartoon and in the context of Palestine and art, specifically political cartoons, I remember the great Palestinian cartoonist Najil Ali.
Yes.
And who was like mostly talking about like anti-racism, the right of return, you know, criticizing the Israeli government, even criticizing some of the thoughts that the PLO have introduced to the Palestinian question. And because of his like criticism to the state of Israel, he was actually assassinated in London.
Yeah.
You know, to what degree do you see that's actually a threat to somebody like you who's doing like cartoon about issues like anti-racism, equality. Now we have like anti-Latino, we have anti-Black. And it was, I remember one of your cartoons, you were talking about, you know, Alabama schools, no Black people, only white people. Here in 2011, it was like, well, we have Black people, but no Latino, criticizing like the new immigration laws, and like how these things are actually a threat for you as an artist, and how do you confront it?
It was mostly my wife who's always, and my family, always worried. After that one incident at USC, I stopped worrying somehow. It seemed to me it was a bluff. I always assumed that these people are trying to silence me by scaring me. So I've never really taken that as a serious threat. And I hope I will I was correct, because I know people who've actually been killed. What the biggest obstacle for me was, as I was talking about earlier, it was censorship. That was the tough thing, because it's very disloyal. It's not even, most of the time, it's not even overt. It's not even somebody telling you, look, you can't do this. It's not an editor telling you, although that's happened too, but usually editors don't like to portray themselves as censors. They try to hint at the problem. They try to discourage you by other means, but they just hate to come out and say, look, you can't do this. But there are so many unspoken ways that it still happens that, for example, if I ended up quitting the newspaper after 8 years when I was at San Bernardino Sun, because they were starting to shrink my cartoons smaller and smaller, and playing, and I was their cartoonist. They were proud in the beginning to have their own political cartoonist. They were paying me, you know, a good living wage for that. But increasingly, as I was not getting the message, they started shrinking the size of the cartoon. They started playing other cartoonists who contradicted my opinion, right against my own cartoon. They started doing so many things that I finally decided it was not worth the trouble anymore, and I just quit. When you have a job as a political cartoonist, it's so difficult to get in the first place that most people will bend. They will, I mean, they have a mortgage, they have a family to feed. They will not go against the consensus at the newspaper, at the company, that you can't say certain things. They will, if they're smart, they will adjust. They will avoid the issue, or they will tone down their cartoons. I was not really able to do that. It was never in my nature. I was too passionate about what I had to say. I felt I was on a mission to say what was not allowed to be said in this country. So I chose to leave. This was in 1995. But thankfully, the internet, just about that time, became so important that just by my presence on the internet, I was able to continue and thrive, because there was this pent-up demand that I didn't know was there. There was the pent-up demand for my kind of cartooning that nobody else was doing in this country. And people in Europe, people in the rest of the world, constantly requesting reprints of the cartoons, because they're stunned and delighted to find an American who's saying these things that nobody else is saying in the cartoon form. I mean, there are other people who will say it in other forms, in other genres, but not in the political cartooning. So by accident, I stumbled upon a niche that made it possible for me to make a living as a political cartoonist, and sticking to my guns, never really having to dilute my message, which was very fortunate.
Yeah, and thanks for that, because without that, we will not have you here with us. And
but it's also a tribute to the country. I mean, it's full of contradictions. On the one hand, there's incredible censorship, even though you're not supposed to talk even about the censorship. On the other hand, it's open enough that people like me, if they're able to, they're allowed to function. Not within the mainstream, but there's so many hundreds and thousands of small newspapers, small websites, small magazines that are completely independent, that are not necessarily wedded to the official narrative of the big media, that you're able to make a living just out of, you know, on the margin. And they don't come to your door like in certain countries and tell you, look, you can't draw this, we're throwing you in jail. So it is a tribute to the country at the same time as, you know, having to recognize that there's a lot of censorship.
Yeah, and speaking of the censorship and mainstream media, that leads me to the next question. Like, you are not born in this country. You're an immigrant to this country. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And with this, like, increasing wave against immigrants and against refugees, and like, how do you see yourself as an Arab American artist facing all of that in the media, in the radio, in the street, and with like the new administration?
Well, it's nothing new, as you know. Unfortunately, it's not as if overnight with Trump things got bad for Muslims, for Arabs, or for Latinos, for all the minorities. Unfortunately, it didn't start with Trump. It got much worse with Trump. But it didn't start with Bush either. It didn't start with 9/11. Unlike what you hear again in the media, that somehow everything changed in 9/11. It's not true. It just made things worse. 1986, more than 30 years ago, already the Attorney General under Ronald Reagan, Edwin Meese, was drawing up lists of Arabs and Muslims and progressives of all stripes to be ready in case concentration camps became necessary, according to him. So we're talking back more than 30 years ago already, this kind of terrible propaganda, this terrible atmosphere was already in the air, so much so that back then, I remember vividly, the Japanese Citizen American League coming out of the woodwork back then already in 1986, saying you cannot draw these lists. We have suffered enough as Japanese Americans that we never will want to see any other community attacked the way we were, and you cannot do this. This was 31 years ago. So how do I feel? I feel increasingly uncomfortable and unhappy, but it's nothing new. It's just getting worse. But at the same time, I'm encouraged by the reaction to this kind of fascism that we're seeing. People, by and large, in this country, a majority of people are not like that. The majority of people are not racist anymore. The majority of people reacted extremely well when that Muslim ban came up. And you'd see people in the airports fighting this Muslim ban. And it was very cheering and reassuring and reaffirming to see that, not just here in California, but across the country, and not just Muslims, and not just minorities, Jewish Americans, white Americans, everybody was there. There's a whole cross-section of people saying, no, this will not happen in our name. So it's a mixed picture. You know, you have really scary, threatening sound of boots, of fascistic boots, which is really unsettling. It's getting worse with somebody like Donald Trump in the White House. At the same time, the majority of people are fighting back, and you're hearing from these people and saying, no way, we're not going to single out anybody, not the Muslims, not the gays, not anybody, not the Jews. The Jews themselves are scared now, some of them. Unfortunately, some of them are very happy, like the Sheldon Adelsons of this world. They think they've got it down pat with Donald Trump, more pro-Israel than anybody before him. But a lot of progressive Jews, I know how it is in Portland, but here definitely we see them. They're coming out of the woodwork and saying, no, this is terrible. It's don't think that it's just anti-Muslim or anti-Latino. This is anti-everybody, including Jews. A lot of Jews are scared now.
now for the Palestinian and the Palestinian community and the Palestinian solidarity community in California and Oregon and the United States in general, like with all of these new legislations that come against anybody who's supporting the boycott, divestment, and sanction movement. And how do you see these legislations, and like how do you, as an artist, like confront it?
Well, again, the same thing we're seeing nationwide for this country, we're also seeing for Israel-Palestine. If you look at the official, the establishment in this country is getting worse and worse, farther and farther pro-Israel in a way that's ultimately not good for Israel. it's really silly.
Other than the Israelis.
Yeah, it's completely suicidal in the long run. But at the same time, when you look at the younger crowd, those young Jewish people, they, according to Norman Finkelstein, among many others, many other professors and intellectuals of this country, who are very close to this issue, who go from campus to campus and meet people, according to them, the younger crowd has had it with Israel. They believe it's bad for them. They don't identify with it anymore. They are embarrassed by it. So again, it's that. That interesting paradox that, yes, on the official level, the same old people with their big money are forcing universities, are forcing legislators, are forcing official Washington to try to do something to kill the BDS. But the BDS is unstoppable because more and more people are saying, enough. You know, we know now. You cannot lie to us anymore. And we're against this colonialism that treats people differently according to their origins, whether they're Jewish or not Jewish. That's nonsense. Even young Jews here are horrified by that. They say, this is not me. So there's both terrible picture at the official level. Now we have someone like Kushner, who's an idiot and knows nothing, and he's got interest in the settlements. He's pro-settlement more than anybody before him, on the one hand. But at the deeper level, you go now to any campus in this country and try to see what happens. The young people are fed up with Israel.
I want to talk about like your new book. I know that you're coming to Portland right now, and you're promoting a new book, and tell us the story, how this book come together and how it's different from your previous publications.
Yes, yeah, so I have two major events in Portland, Saturday and Sunday. Sunday, it's about this big, beautiful exhibit put together by a local church group, wonderful people under the leadership of Sheldon Hurst. And that one is really about the political cartooning and what I've done most of my career. But the previous day at 7 p.m. with the Arab community, I am doing a presentation at the same place, you know, where the cartoons will be displayed. But I will present my book, my latest book that was just published today, which is called V-Rax. It's a graphic novel. I over the past 7 or 8 years, I've done mostly graphic novels, and my first one's called Zahra's Paradise, which was translated in 16 languages. It was a bestseller, a New York Times bestseller. And this one just came out today, is on the topic of mass surveillance. It was inspired by Edward Snowden's revelations a few years ago. And I always admired people like him, whistleblowers who risk their entire life, their freedom, and worse, possibly. It could, you know, if he ever came back, he might be sentenced to death. People who would risk everything just for their for principle, for their belief in democracy, and how democracy is threatened by the state spying on people when they're innocent. So that book is called V-Rax, which in Latin, it was actually one of Snowden's code names, V-Rax, which in Latin means truth teller. So it's about, again, the same theme as telling the truth at great cost, at the risk of your own freedom, at the risk of your own, at the risk of being very poor at the very least, you know, if not thrown in jail. All these people who dare to speak the truth, who've made it their life's work. And it's a graphic novel. It's 200 pages. All of my art really is linked to my political beliefs, and my graphic novels have been also about resistance, resisting political oppression in one country or another, in one context or another. So that's what links all my graphic novels. And I'll be presenting this book through a slide exhibit Saturday at 7 p.m.
It's an honor to have you with us, Khalil Bendib, going through your political journey, your art journey, and how you basically, you know, like any political cartoonist, and you specifically, you know, like you're telling the story at the risk of you being confronted, you being threatened, but that will never stop you from telling the story because people need to know. Is there any final words do you want to say to our Portland listeners before they come and hopefully see you?
I'm delighted to meet the public in Portland. Portland has always been a city that I've looked up to in many ways. I don't know it that well. I was one there just once very briefly. I'm really thrilled to come and spend a couple of days there and meet different types of people. Please come and meet me there. I think it's a hopeful struggle that we're all engaged in. It's not. Sometimes it sounds very pessimistic. It sounds impossible, but the general movement of history is going in the right direction, whether it's here or in the Middle East, South Africa. Things are looking up. People more and more are believing in equal rights, and everybody increasingly will be treated fairly and justly and humanely. And we can all live together in a dignified manner and in a loving fashion. So I really look forward to meeting people at these two events, and thanks very much for having me.
Thanks very much, Khalil, again. And if you would like to come and meet Khalil Bendib in person, you can check Cabo website at cabo.fm/onelandmanyvoices, or you can go and check the Arab American Cultural Center of Oregon. It will be mainly on the 28th of October and the 29th of October. And yeah, Khalil, shukran kteer. Thanks a lot, and we can't wait to see you in person here.
Thank you very much, Mohammed.
And you've been listening to an interview with the acclaimed political cartoonist Khalil Bendib. He will have two events in Portland this weekend to promote his new book about Edward Snowden and whistleblowing. Both events will be held at the First Congregational Church in downtown Portland at 1126 Southwest Park Avenue. Saturday at 7 p.m. will be a reception and meet and greet with the artist, and at 3 p.m. Sunday he will give a lecture called "The Pen is Mightier Than the Sword." Coming up, it's Threshold Shift, a sound artist in residency project, followed at 10:15 by Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Pacific Underground, musician Matt Dorian, formerly known as Snowblind Traveler, talks about his music and experiences as a Filipino-American, plus an in-studio performance. How is all this possible? Well, it can only happen with the support of the community served by community media. That means it's the responsibility of the audience to keep it strong, fierce, and independent, and accountable to no one but the audience. This is how KABU has remained for nearly 50 years now, your independent source for news and entertainment, information and analysis. So you can become a member of the KABU Foundation at kboo.fm. And you click on the word donate. Yes, that's a fun little pas de deux we do with the IRS to maintain a status as a 501c3 tax deductible. That's right. Your investment in your community media, in keeping you and your friends and neighbors and people you've never met and you may not even like very much well informed to be the best citizens of your community you can be, however you define community, however you define citizen. Yes. The only ones doing it around here, and you're the only ones that make it happen. So, without further ado, here is Threshold Shift on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
Hello, and welcome to the final episode of Threshold Shift. I am your host, Nicole Martin. You have allowed us to take you around the globe, across four continents and to the dark waters of the Arctic, from tiny yellow island in the San Juans all the way to Papua New Guinea and beyond Madagascar to the Central African Republic and Panama, for which I thank you sincerely. I've decided that our last selection will simply be a cricket. Why a cricket? Well, this little crooner was singing its heart out one morning last summer, and it struck me. How often does one get the chance to hear a single cricket? Later, as I was studying the spectral graph of the song, I realized that despite my fancy gear and high recording resolution, this one insect was crafting a concerto, or perhaps some haikus. It had tones well above my recorder's ability to capture. The volume changes of single chirps made visual spirals, and I could see the time signature of its rhythms, the precision of which may have been dictated by the spacing of ridges on its legs. Micro distances measured in musical time. It struck me yet again that nature will forever be a source of inspiration and connection if we, as a species, remember it can speak to and through us. As humans, we always have the privilege, potential, even responsibility, to amplify unheard voices, for we are the note keepers, the documenters, the recorders. So often we claim to decide what is worth keeping, how it should be remembered. So often we forget we aren't alone on this planet. There are billions